Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
You started coughing. We haven't even started yet.
Me.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. Did you sing opera before you became a comedian and anti-Trump protester?
No. But I did a lot of musicals as a kid.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's jump in. I'm going to let you introduce yourself rather than me have to create some boring introduction.
Great.
Who are you? Why the hell are you sitting in my house? And should we finish this in the hot tub?
My name is Baratunde Thurston. I needed a place to crash, and this is relatively free. And I am a comedian, I'm a writer, I'm an activist, and I blend all this stuff into a life that somehow has mostly paid for itself at this point.
And so I actually, you needed to stay at my place, and I said I would only let you stay if you did this podcast.
This is my rent.
So this is your rent.
Yeah, I'm a boarder, and this is the compensation.
So I, let's just tell people, you wrote a book called How to Be Black.
I did.
You used to work for The Onion.
Yep.
The Daily Show.
Yep.
And what am I missing here?
I talk a lot.
You do talk
like
a lot.
I'm a professional speaker. Mm-hmm. I have some history in the tech field, though I haven't coded something for real in a long, long time.
Yeah.
But we met through a technology event. We'll argue about what year that happened.
2007.
Probably 2009. And if only there were a way to know facts.
Yes.
But.
So, well, actually, let's just start with the facts.
Yes.
So there's a lot of things I want to talk to you today about. It's actually, there's one thing that I don't really want to talk to you today about, but we are going to talk about because
great.
I feel we need to, which is Kanye West, who I think may be the most annoying person on earth this week.
This week. It's a rotating title. Yeah, that'd be a good award show. Like the annoyees or something. I don't know.
We should do
some
that.
Oscars
we
for should, annoying
we,
people.
We should start that.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about fake news. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about Donald J. Trump. We're going to talk about, what else did we say we were going to talk about in the hot tub last
Probably
night?
Probably some racial things.
That's right. Race.
Oh, data. No, tech and
data.
Yeah.
So where should we begin?
I mean, let's start with annoyance because then we can get that out of the way.
Okay. So I feel like we are living in a culture, and we have been for a while, where if you look back 20, 30 years ago, if you were a conspiracy theorist or an asshole, mm-hmm. You may have gotten attention, but you were a small minority of those people that did.
Yeah.
And I feel like in the world we live in today, the assholes and the annoying people, the ones that want the most attention, are the at the center of the universe and of our attention universe.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is president. Kim Kardashian, I just gagged as I said
right.
that
Kanye
name.
Kardashian.
Kanye Kardashian. Like, they are all just taking up the airwaves all the time, and we play into it. And Kanye this last week, I just couldn't figure out what was going on. And can you kind of tell me?
Yeah, so for anyone who somehow missed it, Mr. West went on another seeming like publicity tour of a moment, aligned himself with Donald Trump fully and firmly, appeared to have blamed slaves for slavery.
Yes.
And saying that, you know, 400 years, that sounds like a choice to be a slave. And just provocative, ignorant, wrong on the information that he was sharing, elevated a conspiratorial alt-right figure, Candace Owens, and literally shared a mic with her, which Kanye, as we all know, famously does not share mics.
Mm-hmm,
so it was a really
mm-hmm.
interesting moment for him to do that. For more analysis and assessment, I recommend people read Dream Hampton's opinion piece in the New York Times that just ran yesterday. And she breaks it down. She's covered hip-hop and like black art for a long time and has done a great job. So I think it's a mix of a person who's hurting. I don't want to be super pissed at Kanye. He's been through things. He has no tools to handle them. And he's aligned himself with people who bring out the worst in him. Like, he's not in the deepest, most introspective, thoughtful home that he could have chosen in the country.
You mean his wife is not looking out for his best interest?
I you know, whatever they think his best interest is, they are very much looking out for that, but it's not serving the rest of us.
Got it.
And he brings down others when he does this because he doesn't just represent himself anymore. So I feel some sympathy for him because it seems like he's been through some tragedies and he's gone through them very publicly, and he's acknowledged going through like body modification, his mom's death, drugs. And he just continues on publicly. He's also so wealthy, he can create a wall around himself and his information. At the same time, he expects us to treat him as like some kind of leader and a god and a deity. And he is not really behaving as if he has our best interest at heart, because he's saying some really harmful and hurtful things. So it's frustrating to be kind.
It's frustrating to be kind. Okay, so, well, you and I both lost our moms, and yeah. I don't see us tweeting about things like that. I mean, is it...
No, but we're not the greatest artists of all time. So, with great power. You're pretty good at podcasting, Nick.
Yeah,
are you the greatest podcaster of all time?
Pretty good hip-hopper. Do you want to hear my hip-hopping?
I do not.
Okay.
Maybe that's for the B-side.
Okay, but in your opinion, as someone who's been doing this for so long and covering all this stuff and so on, do you think that, is this just the new normal that like people him?
I hope not. I'd rather believe in cycles than like some linear development. And we've had a history. We've had people who dominated the tabloids and the front pages. And then they receded. And we've had showboats and showmen. We've had Obamas, right? Like, we've gone back and forth. We've had very serious leaders. We have clowns. We're in a more clownish phase right now. And the gatekeepers are not really there, or their business model encourages it. And then the rest of us can have our id, you know, kind of appeal to by clicking on these buttons to spread all the noise and the nonsense. So I hope that it's more of a cycle and less of a destiny. I don't know what I truly believe yet.
But isn't technology making this worse?
It's speeding up the process, for sure. Like, we don't have time to think about it, and it's relentless. You know, between the time that you press record and right now, we might be in a war. Kanye might announce that he's having a baby. Like, there's all kinds of stuff that could be going down. Or he's running for president as Trump's slave. Like, all of these things are possible.
Yeah.
Maybe they happened, maybe they didn't. But the speed, technology really affects the speed and our ability to reflect on any of the things that are happening and check them.
So the last question about Kanye, because if I say his name again, I might just run into the wall head first. And
you
hope
could use
that
New York Times style of Mr. West.
Yeah, Mr. West. What's the best way to deal with these people? Like, do you kind of try to just block them out? Like, I see people muting them all on Twitter and Facebook and all these places. Or do you try to engage, which is just giving him attention?
I think his friends should engage. They have tried. We know, because he puts their texts out on Twitter. Like, John Legend engaged, and now I know that they both have iPhones. It was blue, so it's like not surprising, but kind of comforting to know that very rich people are using the very expensive device. Like, the world makes sense a little bit. T.I. reached out to him, like another person from his field, and acknowledged that Kanye didn't even know that Trump had proposed this Muslim ban. So I think the people who can reach him, who are close, should continue to try to reach him.
Yeah.
I think the rest of us need to be talking to the people he's also talking to and undoing the damage he's doing.
Yeah.
I think what Van Lathan did in the TMZ video,
calling him out in the moment,
was great. Because otherwise, you know, if you grow up looking up to somebody like that and just watch them rant unchecked, you assume they're telling the truth. Like, why would you assume otherwise? The guy who gave you meaning, whose music gave you life in somewhat literal sense, and gave you esteem and hope and a perspective that mirrored yours, and now he's mouthing off about foreign policy and domestic politics, he's probably right about that too. So I think people like Van are doing a good job. I'm sad that he had to do that, and the interviewers didn't do it, right? He was literally off mic and off camera and did a Hail Mary, like, wait up, hold up, wait a minute. So I want more people to do that. And if you're hearing him or your kids are hearing him, it's unfortunately yet another teachable moment, a growth opportunity to explain to them why this is whack and wrong.
So Candace Owens, who he's now BFFs with, the Fox commentator, who had a little video go viral on the interwebs last week, which was she was giving a talk at I don't know what the event was, but there were some Black Lives Matters folks that started protesting, and she didn't kick them out. She responded to them with the commentary of, you know, this is a choice. Slavery happened X number of years ago, and you continue to use it to your gain, and so on. And that seems to be kind of what Kanye jumped onto. What's the story with Candace and the folks that you know support her kind of level of thinking?
I don't know her.
Yeah.
And I don't know her history deeply.
Yeah.
I do know her argument.
Yeah.
Because there's always been a percentage. Like, there's like 11% of black males in America align with Trump, like support him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about 1 in 10. That's a little much for my comfort. And that number has gone up. There's a big margin of error. Pardon me. But first of all, it's very painful to acknowledge that history affects the now.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a cleaner story. It is a more egotistical story to say, I survived, I thrived, I made this for me, why can't you? I own this house, I'm married with kids, I got this good life, why can't you? You're blaming something that happened before you were born. I'm not. I'm good, you're bad, right? So there's a superiority, there's an arrogance, there's a simplicity that separates you from the rest of those losers.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump is like that. Right. So Kanye and Trump are very similar in that they see the world as losers and they're the winners. And we should all bow down.
Even
to
though
them.
They are the most insecure.
Absolutely.
Of all of them.
But you hide insecurity with more declarations of security and power and awesomeness. So someone like Candace or that argument, you know, the truth of American history is too painful for people to reckon with. Like, if I physically visited the AFAM Museum, the Smithsonian in D.C. just over a month ago. And I know a lot of that history. And I still cried. And it's like, it breaks you down. You're like, oh, this is compound pain. And out of that, beautiful things have been born, but it's pain underneath of all that. So it's psychologically protective, I think, for people like Candace to say, slavery didn't affect me. I wasn't a slave. You're choosing to live in that mentality. Because it would be too painful for her to look and say, well, it actually does affect, if not me, people like me. And so if you can separate yourself from people who are struggling and suffering, that makes you better. If you can separate yourself from a history that's built on pain and suffering, that makes you better. So there's a self-interest and there's a reward. Attention,
yep.
Money, platform, accolades, and you get to play a different type of victim, right? So the irony here is that America's built on victimizing a ton of people. Acknowledging that is painful for all Americans. White Americans, brown Americans, black Americans, it's like, oh, what, are we just products of theft and pain and all that stuff? And so someone like Candace separates themselves and says, I'm not a victim. I'm a victor. But then they play aggrieved when people call them out on the misinformation they're peddling.
Hmm.
And they play victim to the left, to the peddlers of pain, to the Democratic Party, which they like to call the Democrat Party because it sounds like more douchey to say it that way. It's like a low road, like it's like a little rhetorical dig, like a Democrat Party.
Snowflake.
Yeah, it's like, so you're being petty and your brand is I'm not a victim, but your path is victim. And you use victimhood when they're speaking, Trump is a victim, right? This is the man with the most power in the world, and he still needs to play the victim. Now it's the deep state. Like, you control the largest military ever assembled. You sit atop the largest economy the world has ever known, and yet you're still the loser.
And so,
you're still the victim.
And so why do you think that is for people?
I think there's comfort in it. I think feeling like, you know, it puts anything you do wrong or any criticism that might be sound, it dismisses it. Because the people leveling it, they're jealous. They don't understand you. They're afraid of you. I mean, even the language that Kanye was using, you fear free thought. It's mm-hmm. like, no, I fear whack thoughts. I fear dangerous thoughts. Like, you're not, this is not free thinking. This is free of thinking. Like, you're literally, your thinking is faulty. And so I think people lean on that because it allows them to avoid acknowledging that they might be wrong, that they're insecure, that they have doubts, that they're like, they may just not know something. Like, Trump mostly doesn't know stuff. But he can't acknowledge that. So all news is fake, right? That's how, like, your insecurity has to be so high that any criticism must be a lie, perpetuated by billions of people. He is the world's biggest conspiracy theorist because he thinks we're all out to get him. And it's not even about him, you know?
All right. So let's switch gears a little bit.
Yeah.
You have been working on recently a lot of stuff with data and privacy and security, and you have these theories that the world that we live in today, of where everything is collected and put into a little algorithm and stored in a big database, yeah, is going to be atrocious for the world we live in tomorrow. Is that an apt?
That's pretty fair. It's not my thinking alone, though I have been talking about it more recently.
Yeah.
I was honored a few years ago. I got this award at South by Southwest. Mm-hmm. It was like a Hall of Fame award, and I'm like young, so I'm like, is this it?
Am I going out to pasture?
Is this how I find out that my life is over? I feel like I've like done a third of the stuff I want to do. But in accepting that, I had this phrase where, you know, technology people, and you cover this field formally for much longer than I've been even a part of it, we're making the world a better place. And it's been an assumption that all this tech makes things better, and that progress just kind of passively happens if you apply bits to it and processing resources and like memory. But what if we're making the world a worse place faster, right? Goodness isn't a guaranteed outcome of investing.
Yep.
And so when you start thinking about machine learning, data processing, algorithms, we could make things really hard for ourselves. Police departments are starting to use this data to determine where they send police resources. Sentencing, like courts are using it to develop sentencing guidelines. Teachers are being assessed.
How are they using it in courts?
So they're using it to determine what the bail settings are for people.
And they're getting this data from just the
from
same...
our racist history.
Got it. And then how are they determining the bail settings based on that?
So they will, based on where you live, they will determine a risk of your recidivism likelihood, you know, to commit a crime in between your court date, you know, and now. And so they will set a number, or they'll set a guideline for probation or sentencing around that, not based on your behavior, just based on your zip code.
And also not based on trying to avoid you ending up back in prison, but trying to keep you in there.
Yeah. And Kathy O'Neill's written a beautiful book, Weapons of Math Destruction. Sophia Noble has a phrase, Algorithms of Oppression. These are two names people should get familiar with, and that's just on the algorithmic side. But when, you know, the idea of looking at a large set of data to make better decisions in the future, that sounds dope. Like, I do it every day. I love spreadsheets. But if the data that you're looking at is itself corrupted, then the future you're building will be corrupted. And so the history that we're building all this data on is corrupt. Like, policing has been racist in the past. So if you look at historical racist policing data, you'll create, like, a racist RoboCop future, right? We'll have a racist Skynet future if we don't intervene and try to make some actively different choices.
So what do you think are some of the things that could happen? I mean, is it that we
Well, I said racist Skynet, so yep. We'll have drones.
Okay. But, but is it that you go to apply for a job and they know who you are before you, they know more about you than you do, and then decide if you're going to be the right candidate? I mean, give me some examples.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, look, there are great scenarios already. Like, Netflix tells me about a German series that I would love that I never would have known, and I lose productivity more effectively because of that. So that's a dope algorithm for Netflix. Maybe for my earning potential, not so much, but I am entertained. Like, they're delivering on a promise. The future job market might be as simple as I don't even see the job offer because it is targeted away from me based on assumptions about who would do this job well. Or I get a different mortgage rate based on some assessment of my likelihood to pay that is unsound, but rolled out rapidly and at scale, building on all these other signals that I have not given explicit consent that that's how you should deal with me as a possible customer. Or law enforcement stuff. Like, I can always come back to law enforcement because it's literally life and death. So it will be subtle. I don't think it's necessarily going to be digitally enhanced jackbooted thugs showing up at your door.
Nice Wayne LaPierre reference there.
Thank you. Thank you. But we could all have these fragmented realities. Some with more opportunity, some with more freedom than others. And we will have enabled it today by accepting terms of service that we didn't fully understand, by allowing a level of tracking that we thought was just helping us drive more efficiently, but was also powering these other major decisions about credit, about jobs, about love, about communications that we didn't have truly informed consent about when we made that choice today.
Hmm. So is there a way to not end up in this world without you not using the products?
Yeah, good question. And I'm not an advocate of unplugging everything. I am surrounded by Apple products right now. And I get great joy and some productivity and just like whimsy out of all this stuff.
You want to buy my used iPad? I'm not really using it.
Nah, anymore. I'm good. I got enough iPads.
Got it.
One is actually enough.
Yes. Turns out I actually think one is probably too much.
For many people. Yeah. But for the planes, I'm on planes all the time. It's like, then, anyway, I'm not here to sell iPads.
Yeah.
That's literally the opposite of what I'm trying to talk about. Damn it. That's how good they are.
Yeah.
Like I just went from criticizing tech to selling tech in a second.
Wait, so what are you supposed to do? It's like we have these.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't use social media that much anymore. I don't even have Instagram on my phone.
A big step. I don't know if you've disclosed how much you were such a baller on Instagram back in the day.
Oh, I remember. Like, I was one of the first people on there.
Yeah, you had so many followers. Like, I remember talking to our friends, like, Nick is really killing it on this.
I was using it all the time. I loved it because my photo of that photo we took of that cappuccino is just really breathtaking.
Yeah.
I was a photographer. You know, I started taking photos in high school. My dream job was to be a war photographer. Literally, like, I read all the books. I like interned for James Noctaway's black and white printer. That was the dream job for me. And so somehow I ended up covering tech for the New York Times and Vanity Fair. But eventually, you know, when Instagram came out, I remember I knew the guys that had started it and I downloaded it instantly and was like, this is amazing. And I thought it was really great. And then all of a sudden, I found myself just scrolling and scrolling.
Which is what they want you to do because they hacked your brain, right? And you talked about this on the show.
And I didn't feel like, there was anything good coming out of it. I didn't feel like if I read a book, even if it's a bad book or I don't agree with the book or something, or watch a movie that is, you know, informative or entertaining or heartfelt or something, like I walk away and I think about it and there's some emotion. You turn off Instagram, that's it.
Yeah.
That's a period of your life.
Turn on Instagram, turn off your brain.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
It's like super TV.
But you can't do that with everything.
Yeah.
So what is...
Walking away is a luxury, honestly, for some people, or psychologically, financially, and socially, very expensive, right? It's like, don't have a phone line. Okay, don't have friends. You know, just get rid of your cell phone. That's cool. Like, if you live in an enclave, or if you're Amish, or if you're in, like, a hunter-gatherer type society, like, there are places where you don't really need a cell phone, but in the modern world, they're hard to find. So in terms of, like, managing personal data, I think there's some ways that we can go as individuals. Right, there's a responsible consumer kind of mindset, buyer beware sort of thing. Read a couple terms of service, understand the privacy settings. Like, get your hands a little dirty and play around. But I think the problem's too big to rely on, like, us individually making better choices, because they are collectively undermining them with trillions of dollars worth of value extraction. Like, they literally have machines countering our will.
Yep.
And they're learning and they're getting better.
Which is what the podcast last week was about with Tristan. So,
and not just on the behaviors that they're encouraging, but on the value they're extracting. Like, it is in their economic interest to track us as much as possible, to target us. Like, we've taken all the greatest engineering minds of the world to sell us ads, right? And that's like underwhelming at a minimum. So I think there's some structural stuff that we could do, which involves, we don't have to build a world where we extract the maximum amount of data to sell stuff that we don't want to people who don't need it. Like, that was a choice that we made. And we could make a different choice. So we could censor this not on advertising money, but on value that we get from the service, like me and you as the users of the service. We could change the dynamic. So, you know, a company like Facebook will say your data is yours, but they don't operate that way.
No.
Right? They extract a bunch of stuff, mostly without our knowledge. It turns out other people are doing things mostly without their knowledge, right? But they had no incentive to protect our data because it wasn't ours. In their minds, legally, financially, it was theirs to do with as they pleased.
And it was their business model.
Yeah. And their investors were cool with it. The markets were cool
Wall
with
Street
it. The press was cool with it. Everybody was celebrating, writ large, everybody, in big quotation marks. But if it was ours, like if somebody came to your house and took all your kids' toys and all your computers and all your clothes, and when you were off at work, they were renting it out to other people, selling it, making triple money on top of it, and you got none of that, that would be criminal burglary at scale. That is like conspiracy to rob a people. And that's the business model of these companies. So I think we have to adjust, whose data is it? Okay. Like if we assumed it was ours and we had to consent and we got value out of it, I think that would shift some of these incentives around.
So I agree with you completely. And I think that, you know, it would be like me saying, hey, everyone, let's just not pay attention to Kanye this week. You know, let's yeah. he didn't take
like,
his meds.
Just say no doesn't work at scale.
Exactly. So how do we counter this if the only way you can counter is by not interacting? How do we do it?
No,
we can't not interact.
So that's not the only way.
Okay.
And I think I haven't been clear enough. I think we need to change our rules, our regulations, our norms at a minimum. But as we're finding out with our president, norms aren't always enough. So probably rules that say this stuff belongs to us. It will slow down the extraction and allow us to, you know, consent or not consent at smaller levels. I think the people who are building on top of us, who are like mining us, there's like a handful. Right? It's Amazon, it's Facebook, it's Google, Alphabet, it's Tencent and Baidu, like there's 10 companies. They shouldn't be the only ones, like we should be able to use that too. And you see this effort to get researchers working with Facebook. You see Google just announcing they're not going to sell ads for jail bail bondsmen because that is the most exploitative commercial operation we have, which is built on the legacy of slave catching. Like that's not something you should want your corporate legacy to be a part of. Mm. So there are ways to use these tools for something other than what they've been used for. And I think that if we unlock some of that creativity for us, then it won't be so lopsided. It's not just that they're doing bad things that we haven't fully consented to, that we are not being allowed to control the use of ourselves either. And that would balance the scale some.
You know, what's really interesting. A few weeks ago, I was talking to someone from YouTube and who formerly used to be YouTube. And they were saying to me that when there was the backlash to all these videos, the ones that were targeting kids, all these different things, that advertisers actually started to pull out.
Mm-hmm.
And it massively affected their bottom line last year. And I think that... that the more vociferous we are, the you can actually have an impact.
Yeah.
And the more noise people make, there will be repercussions. What's so sad though is, you know, you see what happened with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, and Zuckerberg goes before Congress, and next thing you know, they have 70 million new daily active users. I have a theory though, actually. Yeah. My theory is that those 70 million daily active users that are now using it more or whatever it was, that they were signing up trying to figure out how to change their privacy settings.
No, I mean, if you did a heat map of the Facebook site where that activity was happening, it's on the settings page.
Yeah.
It's on that app setting that no one ever looked at before.
Yeah.
And they're like, 400 apps have access to my religious preferences. What? I just wanted a discount on burritos, man. Like, that is not a fair trade. So those are a few things. These guys set defaults. You know, defaults determine destiny. It's not a thing I've ever said before, but I think... their default was all your data belongs to us. You can set a different default, which gives us control. If they can create a layer of drones to provide wireless internet to rural parts of the earth, they can allow us more control over our privacy settings.
Completely.
Like this is technically possible. They just weren't encouraged to do it. Their investors didn't make them do it. The press didn't hold them to it early on. And they built an empire on lazy forms of exploitation and like a certain lack of creativity. But they've been creative in so many other things. They've proven they can.
They can. Absolutely. So 1,000%.
So we gotta hold them to the fire a little differently too.
Okay, so I have a question. So last night I found myself on the internet and I started reading about chlorine and I ended up, and I'll get to why.
Yeah.
I ended up on a Wikipedia page and reading about the guy who invented chlorine, who also invented, it was in Germany during World War I.
This is a classic internet rabbit hole.
This is a classic internet rabbit hole, but stay with me here.
Okay.
And he also invented the things that helped plants grow. He invented, you know.
Water?
No.
I mean, he must be rich if he invented water.
No, it's escaping my brain.
Sure. Okay.
When you water, you give food to your plants.
Yeah.
What is it called?
Plant food?
Kind of. Let's just call it. The chemical term is plant food.
I'm real
food.
Smart, y'all.
Yeah. But he also created the first chemical weapons. He's considered the father of chemical warfare. Mustard gas, things like that, so on and so forth. the things that he created, these chlorine gases and so on, also later after he died, ended up becoming the thing that we used to fight cancer, right? Mm. So this was an individual, and he was fully aware. He had no qualms with creating things that help society yeah. or destroy society. He said death is death, and there's no difference in how you die in his mind. Really kind of a fucked up individual. But the thing that I was thinking about in terms of what he did is, from one hand, you get chemical weapons that killed millions of people mm-hmm. or hundreds of thousands of people during the First World War, and now are being used in Syria and so on. But on the other hand, you get the things that are used for chemotherapy yeah. to cure cancer, quite literally. When you look at technology and social media and all of these things that are happening, and the denigration of democracy and the heightening of celebrity yeah. in a very negative way, the fact that kids, this study after study after study that says kids on Instagram are more depressed than kids that aren't, Facebook is you know, taking your data and yeah. knows what color underwear you're wearing, all these things. Do you think that the pros outweigh the cons? It's, do you know what I'm saying?
No, I know exactly what you're saying.
I mean, it's like, you, on one hand, you've got Black Lives Matter and Me Too and this, that, and the other. Yeah. On the other hand, you have Trump. Mm-hmm. And you have misinformation and fighting and...
No, and they're both unleashed by the same forces.
Exactly.
And they're both built with the same set of tools. Yeah. To even be more literal about it. I don't know, Nick. It's not an obvious that pros win. And I want pros to win, but I think there's a deeper, I'm not trying to get out of the question and get all like law school. Like, I challenge the premise of the question, but I think we're being exposed as people that we can't answer, that questions like that aren't answered passively. We act on them to make the answer we want to be more true, which means we have to engage with it. And it comes back to what we were talking about earlier. Like, tech doesn't just bring goodness. It doesn't bring better life. It can bring better, like faster and worse death. This guy that you just found through your internet rabbit hole speech is proof of that. Curing cancer, killing people. Innovation, science, progress, magic, technology. And who was around him to influence that development? Who funded it to go one way or the other? How was it socialized? Were people who were going to be using the product involved in its deployment? Or was it some group off in a distance, assuming they knew all the use cases, unleashing this on everybody and not seeing or not anticipating bad actors and negative users? Facebook was warned many, 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 many times about the harm that this platform could cause. They chose to not incorporate that feedback into the product well over a decade ago.
Sorry, fertilizer, that's what he invented.
AKA plant food.
Yeah, okay. Plant food. All right, keep going, keep going, keep going.
So I don't, because if we solve this question by saying the pros win, then that lets us off the hook. And we're like, well, net, net, more good will happen, so let's charge forward. If we've resolved this question and say the cons win, then it's like, well, we got to stop. I mean, no matter how much good comes from, the evil will outweigh the good, so we shouldn't do this anymore. And we've been at this for long enough in our history as a species that whether we're talking about cars or wheels or axes, or planes, or fertilizer, it can swing either way. And the difference isn't inherent, I don't think, in the technology. It's like how we approach it, and like, can we change what we put into the system to alter that answer and make the pros win more? Because if the cons win, then what do we do? I don't know. And if the pros win, it's like hands off, we just have to tolerate the evil that comes from these systems. And that doesn't seem right.
And so it seems to me that what you're saying is that there's a responsibility for the people that make the thing to ensure that the positives outweigh the negatives.
To the best, I think there's a new ring of accountability that we have. You know, here's what is happening. I think the cost of being of ignorance is increasing because the speed of these tools' development is so fast. You know, the development of the automobile and how long that took to saturate the planet is like orders of magnitude slower than what we've experienced with mobile phones or with social media or what we're likely to experience with artificial intelligence. So the cost of getting it wrong is much higher. And so in that sense, things are different. But yeah, more accountability, which, you know, not just, so for the people who make it, who's making it? Let's just start there. Who are the people making it? And who are the people funding the making of it, right? If we had more people who were subject to these technologies, actually involved in the development of them, we would have different outcomes. Just like if more women were involved in medical studies, like the development of pharmaceuticals would be different. They were all tested on male bodies. So who's in the room? Let's get Hamilton on it. Who's in the room where it happens? Widen that set. One important step.
Do you worry that the future, I mean, I get to AI a lot in this, yeah, in these conversations, but the people building AI are pretty much affluent white people?
I worry about that for many things. And I worry about that for television programming.
But okay, it seems that the potential...
Food trucks.
So the thing, yoga, that's so fascinating... For what'd you say, food trucks?
Yeah, just, there's a lot of things affluent white people are driving right now.
It's true. It's definitely true. When you think about the... Okay, so one thing that's so fascinating that I think a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of the world that we live in today is not a direct result of Trump or even Obama. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of it is actually a direct result of Reagan. You know, the initiatives that Reagan put forward.
Yeah.
You know, removing the mental health system, some of the new gun law, the fact that the gun laws were overturned, yeah, in the 70s, all these different things around the economy, agriculture, so on and so forth, are direct results of decisions that were made in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. A lot of the imprisonment are actually direct result of things that Clinton did in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to see the effects of what... We're not even seeing the effects necessarily of what Obama did yet.
Yeah.
And we're not going to see the effects of what Trump has done for a decade plus. Is this something that you worry about? I mean, I worry about with AI that these people who are affluent and white and make $500,000 to $10 million a year or whatever it is are building the future and the negative repercussions that could come with that.
Yeah, no, very worried. Very worried.
But is there something that can be done?
Lock them up. Lock them up. Lock them up for future crimes.
Don't look now, but there's a robot right behind you that, nice, is about to decapitate you.
Awesome. Awesome. From the future.
From the future.
Hello, Terminator. Yeah, I do worry about it, like, truly in many things. And I think the cost is higher because it's infecting everything, right?
Yep.
Intelligence of some kind will be in the air we breathe, probably in the future or very close to it. We are installing monitors in our houses for some gains right now that we can't see the cost of later. But so what do we do with that? And I think, you know, initiatives like OpenAI, there's a group, there's a group who has an AI Now Institute, like they're starting to ask these questions.
We'll just call them the Plant Food
Institute. The Plant Food Institute, yes. I know it's called the AI Now Institute. I can't remember the names of the women who run it. But they're asking those questions now before it's like embedded in every object in our homes and in our lives and in our kind of economies. And I don't, you know, do we not do it at all? I don't think that's possible. I think, mm-hmm, there's too much money behind already. There's too much greed. There's too much curiosity, natural or inflated by economic
desires. I was at the Milken Institute last week, and you know, tickets are $50,000. It's all,
wow.
I didn't pay. I went on press pass. And there was a session on AI, yeah, and the singularity, and they had these, you know, it was four white guys and one white woman on, yeah, stage, and actually there was an Indian guy, And I was so excited because I was like, oh, they're going to these, they're very powerful people in the, yeah, room. There's, you know, officials from the U.S. government that were there speaking. You know, Paul Ryan was there. And
I mean, he doesn't count.
He doesn't
count. He's abdicated, right, his,
yeah, role. But there were, you know, the U.S. Commerce Secretary. And I said, oh, this is going to be great. They're going to have this conversation about what could go wrong. And the entire conversation, yeah, was about all the ways that the people on that stage could make more money, and, yeah, all the financial upsides. And people kept asking, even the moderator, who was this Forbes contributor, said, is there anything you worry about?
Yeah.
And there was one guy who was like, no, I think it's going to be great. I don't think we need to worry about anything. And job loss. And I was just like, oh my God, I wanted to scream.
Yeah, we're going
to
get this so wrong. That's not cool.
No, it's not.
So because I'm pretty optimistic, like by default. My default setting is pretty optimistic. With a sprinkling of like history happened, don't forget that. People can be horrible, but we can be better. It's like my mantra. We can be better. And hearing that is depressing and infuriating because I know we can make a different choice. Like AI doesn't have to just be used to stalk us and sell us garbage. It can be used to like expand justice, right? We can use it. We have 17,000 police forces in this nation.
How many?
17,000.
Police forces.
Yeah, it's a highly fragmented market to use like business speak. And they got different rules and regulations and behaviors. And last week, I emceed a celebration of the science of justice because this organization, the Center for Policing Equity, partnered with Google.org to use data and analysis to bring more justice to the police departments. They got police chiefs on board to let academics in, look at their raw data, understand bias, understand use of force, where that overlap negatively, and the community is a part of this effort. So in a literal room, there are Black Lives Matter activists, police chiefs, technologists, and academics using tech for more justice, not more inequality, more inequity, more horrors. So it's technically possible, man, and it's so frustrating that you're at an event of super brains, and all they can talk about is...
I would say super wallets.
Super wallets.
Yeah.
With you know, well-supported brains, right? With coddled brains, with encouraged brains, and their priority is getting richer. And that's, I'm sure there was a few other things, but basically that's, they want to make more money, and they're only looking at like the upside for the part of the world they can see. And in a lot of science fiction movies, you know, when the aliens come, when we start doing interplanetary exploration, you get like this international commission of people, like on behalf of the human race, we got to sign off on this. And so you have delegates from all parts of the world, and we're going to coordinate our response to the invasion or our funding of the exploration, whether inbound or outbound. It's too big of a problem to leave to just one nation. And I feel like the artificial intelligence future and tech in general is just too big of an opportunity and too big of a risk to leave to the people who happen to have the pedigree and the social status and the historic inheritance of privilege to derive that future for the rest of us. Like, it's irresponsible for our species to have that panel drive the future for everybody. So we don't need to lock them up, but we do need to calm them down and diversify them. And we need to hold our political leaders accountable. Paul Ryan obviously doesn't represent us. Like, he represents the billionaire non-taxpayers of the world, and he's fine with everything else that's going on so long as he got his damaging tax cut. But technically, his job is a check and balance within our government, and I think on the behalf of the people he represents, which as speaker isn't just the folks of, you know, Janesville, Wisconsin, which he doesn't, he shouldn't even represent because of gerrymandering. That's probably another show. Like, he's an artificial representative.
Yes, he is
like
an
AI, yes, in a way. Like, he only exists because of an algorithm that defined a border that he could win.
Mm-hmm.
So he can't win in a fair fight. That's what I'm
saying.
That's
why he's not going to.
That's why he's running from Iron Stash.
Yeah. All right, let's wind down here.
Yeah, calm me down, my goodness.
And let's talk about something good. Comedy. So you have been a comedian for what, decade now?
More? Oh man, technically, I don't know. I've been producing comedic material since 1996. I started with a comedy newsletter in college, so we're like 22 years in to the field in some form or other, whether it's stand-up or book writing or lecturing.
You know? And you were at The Onion.
I was.
The Daily Show.
It's a great job.
Actually,
great job.
You know what? This is not going to be happy. I'm going to ask you. So The Onion, you guys create these kind of fake funny stories, and you've been doing it for a long time, mm-hmm. and they're great. Do you think that, is there a world in which that played an influence on the world that we live in today of fake news?
Oh,
And as you think about this, yeah. The thing that I've come to realize as of late is that another topic I want to get to before we wrap up,
yeah.
but the rise of the right, there is no question whatsoever that the rise of the right is in response to the rise of the left and the PC world that we now have to live in, and I say have to because I feel like it goes too far, mm-hmm. a lot of the time, and we can talk about that. And the response was the alt-right and so on and so forth, and people have been talking about this, sociologists and psychologists and even the Unabomber have been talking about this for decades, that this was what was going to happen. And I wonder if that... inadvertently, you know, things like The Onion,
yeah.
kind of helped set a playbook essentially for the fake news world that
I will not own that because it would make me feel terrible. I'm going to pull a Candace Owens.
I'm trying to
say that's not my history.
I'm going to try to make you feel terrible.
Those folks chose that. Yeah. All right. I'm independent of my past. I will cop to that. There's definitely a relationship. I think what The Onion wasn't created in an organized, funded, weaponized manner to like undermine faith in the idea of information.
What was it created to do?
I mean, it is created artistically to comment on society. I think it's created as a like satire in general, as an art form, is a check on authority and uses tools of language to highlight hypocrisies, discrepancies, abuses of power, just behaviors of those who are installed, whether it's going back to, who's my man?
Plant food.
Fertilizer.
Mr. Plant Food.
Whether it's going way back to someone like Horace, which is like ancient, literally, or to some of our more contemporary voices. America pushed this a lot, whether it's, the Dick Gregorys of the world who were using scathing satire. Frederick Douglass was using scathing satire in some of his work. So it's a tool of expression to call out things. And I think what the right has done with it is far less artistic in some ways and far more targeted in others. Like they are chipping away at some of the foundational blocks that are like the premise of society itself, that we can agree that certain things happened. The Onion was never challenging reality so directly and certainly wasn't undermining it. It was, I think, artistically pushing at it. And, there is this alternate universe that it was creating, but it was, to most people, clearly as art, not as propaganda. I think there's a difference between, and it can be a blurry line, between the art of something like The Onion and the propaganda of, the 4chans coupled with the Breitbarts, coupled with funding from who knows who.
Oh, yeah.
From Mercer, right? Yep. And weaponized. Like, The Onion wasn't weaponized and targeted in such an interesting way. So there is a relationship.
Do you think that...
The execution is totally different.
Do you think that that there is a world of... we live in a post-truth world. Do you think that there's a world in which we will ever be able to live in a truth world again?
Yeah. How? Yeah, because there are cycles to these things. And... I don't think history repeats. I don't think it's a circle. I've said this in some other places before. If anyone's ever heard me speak before, I think it's a spiral. And so we revisit familiar coordinates, but it's never exactly the same.
And you're spiraling up, not down.
See, literally, just for you guys that are listening, understand, I had a visual of my hand in a spiral moving in an upward, positive direction.
In my mind, I was spiraling down.
Because he hears spiral, and he thinks down.
Yeah.
And I think probably if
let me just ask you a question.
People,
this glass is a glass of water here. Is that half full or half empty?
It is a glass with great potential. That glass could be filled with more justice, Nick. That's so what I see, an opportunity.
You see an AI opportunity.
Yes. I don't think that... I think we can get to a place where we have some shared reality again. And I say that because backlash is part of progress. Like, there is a history of this. If we look at the brief life of the United States of America, we had it. We had a formal slave state where it was baked into the Constitution, built the economy, and we undid a big chunk of that. We had Reconstruction right after that. We had record numbers of black male legislators elected to state houses all over the country. Public education came from those legislators. Right? That happened. People were getting land. We were back on our feet. We had an Equal Rights Amendment proposed that wouldn't come about in the civil rights movement for another 90 years. And then the Klan came and was like, nah, we're going to burn all your stuff down. Like, that's too much for us. Our whiteness is so fragile, we can't accept your blackness being human. Mm. And so we crushed it. And we swing forward and we yank back. And so, like, Trump is a backlash to Obama.
Yep.
Right? And there is a relationship that is not just about the present moment. I think it's part of the flow of history and societies in general, and how we manage that, we can get better at. That's why I think we'll manage our way back to something more like truth.
Do you think, and I know this is not your expertise, but I think what you just said
has never stopped me before, Nick. I'm an American, all right? I'm an entertainment.
No, but what you said is completely correct. Everything is a backlash to everything. Like I said before, the right was a backlash to the left, and there will be a response, and there's a response to the right, which
blue
is...
Blue waves, you know, coming, right?
But it seems that, and I don't know the history of this, but it seems that just in my lifetime, those... that spiral has become more volatile.
Yeah.
It's just crashing mm-hmm. to the left, crashing to the right.
Higher beta, is it?
A higher beta. So like it's intense.
Yes.
And I feel like technology is doing that. I mean, you know, this week there was a New Yorker story by Ronan Farrow that, you know, the AG
Eric Schneiderman
yeah. had been, you know, beating up girlfriends and been violent and so on and so forth. And Not even 3 hours, 2 hours and 57 minutes, he resigned yeah. after that piece. In a world a decade ago, it would have taken months.
Yeah.
I mean, it probably would have resulted, hopefully would have resulted in the same thing, but it would have, in the speed, I mean, you literally could have been in a movie yesterday and missed everything.
Yeah, like, as a New Yorker, you could have gone to the movies with an attorney general
yeah.
and come out with no attorney general.
Yes, exactly. do you think that that technology can... slow that volatility?
Yeah, can we use it as a dampener and not just an accelerant?
Yes.
That's a really good question. I like
that's
a
good
man.
Question, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's worth exploring more. So I'm not an expert in these things either. I'm an observer of, I read, I absorb osmosis information through hot tubs or whatever. And I definitely hope so.
And I'll give you, let me just give you a caveat to this. Yeah. In the speed with which we get information today mm-hmm. is fascinating. When you look back during the First World War, it took 2.5 days to get news
yeah.
from the front. By the Second World War, it was down to like 1.5 to 2 days. If you go to the 80s, it still took 12-hour periods sometimes to get news, even yeah. though you had these today, there are predictive AIs yeah. that are telling you the news before it fucking happens.
Yeah.
So
no, it's frightening. And so I think there's a deep question, and it's probably like a biological, maybe neurological question. Is there a speed that's too fast for like human cognition, for absorption, for useful reflection? 12 hours maybe better than 2 hours? Is 2 hours markedly better than 2 minutes? Is 2 minutes better than 2 nanoseconds? Like, what's the threshold of where it's mostly destructive and not safe at any speed, so to speak? I think that's a fascinating question. I'm probably going to answer your question with some questions that somebody else should dig into more. I'm going to be thinking about this for a while. I also think that we could probably use our technology in creative ways to not just make everything more overwhelming and faster, but to give us rooms to breathe and space to consider, to outsource certain more automatable decisions to the edge and say, okay, let's let the machines handle that so that I can ponder the deeper questions. That's what we've done with technology. That's what we could have done with technology so far. We created washing machines, right? We created levels of automation that we benefit from without even thinking. And it was supposed to give us more time to think. And it just gave us more time to work.
Yep.
And work harder and generate more money to fund this consumer economy. But that too was a choice. It was a structural choice. Like individually, people were like, I want to work more. The way we set up our society demanded that we work more so that when women entered the workforce, it didn't relieve the family. It put more stress on the family. Because now expenses are up, and what we've done to the housing crisis, what we've done to unions, what we've done to healthcare and destroying childcare, like, okay, but these are all choices. So I think it's complex, and I think it's a hard, like, delicate choreography. But I think we could build with technology for us, build with the people who are making it, so that it served us. And we're still in a dynamic where we serve it, and we're trying to play catch up to this it that other people made. And we have to step out of it for a minute and ask, what do we want? Like, what do we need? Who are we? And then let's answer those questions with technology, et cetera. Because we could have that. You know, Tristan's work, you had him on your show, and he helped me think about this concept of time well spent. And the way Facebook publicly measures its value for the longest time is how much time we spend on it. The more time you spend on Facebook, the better it is for Facebook, thus the better it is. And you could flip that around and say the more time you spend on Facebook, the worse a product Facebook is. If it takes you 4 hours a day per user to deliver value, you're doing something wrong. I want a Facebook where I get amazing value in 60 seconds. Like, why don't we race in the opposite direction? How much of your life can I give back to you as a technology company? How little screen time do you need to get value from my service? What if Instagram asked that? The three dopest pictures you need to see before you get back to your damn life. We could optimize in another direction. So I don't, that's not the default. We're not naturally heading there, but we could. And if there's one thing I got to reiterate for my own sanity, is that we got to try.
All right. Last little question, and then I know you have to run. We talked a little bit about political correctness, and I sometimes feel that it's gone too far. If you want to make fun of me or my heritage or whatever it is, as long as you're not being too mean or rude, it's like, well, fine, you know, like, and I know that there's pain and there's history in a lot of the things that we are very sensitive to today. But do you think it's gone too far? Or
sometimes. And I think there's so many caveats on this.
Yeah, this is a difficult conversation.
And it's another podcast.
Yeah.
So I'll try to be brief because I can run on. I'm reading a book. My girlfriend and I are both reading it. She started it before me. It's called Kill All the Normies. Mm-hmm. And it describes internet culture, the rise of this new Nazism, white supremacy, a.k.a. alt-right, and the transgressive nature of their work, which actually originated in the left transgressing the mainstream. And so this is a response to that being a response. And it does call into question some of how the left has operated, reacted. The term microaggressions, like I consider that a microaggression. I just don't like the word. Mm-hmm. And I think it sounds small, but I don't want to minimize. I don't think it's as simple as kids on college campuses are too sensitive or people can't take a joke. I think the intentions of the joke teller and the context make a lot. I think if communities of kind of derogatory humor and playfulness are used to deny opportunity, aka a bunch of dudes making horrible jokes about women in their private space while they create economic opportunity for themselves that those women could never join.
Oh, you're talking about Silicon Valley.
Right. And I was thinking Wall Street, mirror coasts. You know? I think that's a problem and worth examining. And I think as an artist.
But as a comedian.
Yeah, no, and as an artist, it's a creative challenge to try not to step on those minefields, and it can be exhausting. Like it's not all, I don't embrace it all the time. And I do. You know, I feel old, like I'm 40, and I'm like, am I 60? You know, because I work on college campuses a lot, and I've gotten to debates, discussions, arguments with students, and part of me is looking at them and it's like, you're doing your job, you're pushing us, that's great. I was you 20 years ago, and I was saying to some 40-year-old, more, faster, more. And then another part of me is like, are you considering the effects of this? Is it too fast? Do we need more nuance in how we embrace? Closing thought, and this is... I can't overestimate like how much more this needs to be discussed, but we can't do this right now. There is a burden on people who have been oppressed to consider their oppressors in their own liberation. I'll repeat that again like a preacher. There is a burden on those who have been oppressed to consider their oppressors and how they fight for their own freedom. And
explain what you mean.
To sub in values, Black people got to care about white people's feelings as we fight for Black freedom because we can't actually do it without them. Because we see what happens, they re-Nazify. You know what I'm saying?
I just had a picture of the Terminator in
you
my
heard
mind.
This, you heard it here
re-Nazify.
First. They re-Nazify. And it's exhausting. It's exhausting to explain things that you think people should know by now. It's exhausting to defend your right to exist. And I'm not just talking about Blackness. I think women are going through this. I think so many different groups that are trying to assert their humanity. And in the face of that, because all of us have grown up in this stew, we're all actually victims of it in different ways. Mm-hmm. And to not consider what happens to the ego, to the self-identity of the person who never consciously chose their identity in their life, whether they had power or not.
Yeah.
Is unhelpful, right? It's unfair to ask that of oppressed people, but it is necessary to achieve freedom. Mm-hmm. And it requires a level of patience and compassion and love that is beyond, that is so much. But I think strictly advocating for what you want at all costs will generate a backlash that you'll then have to contend with, or your kids will have to contend with, or their kids will have to contend with. So managing that, managing your oppressor's emotions as you fight for your own freedom, that's a difficult task list, but I think that's part of how we get to a place of political correctness going too far. It's like, well, are we bringing everybody along on the ride? Like, how do we make this invitation?
No, it's fascinating. Yeah. I think you're completely right. I think it's if you know, when I do spend a little bit of time on Twitter here and there, and I see everyone attacking everyone because they said something wrong or asked the question wrong or made a statement wrong. And I mean, I remember in the beginning of the Me Too movement, there were people who had tweeted, you know, these men who had tweeted, if you're I'm a husband and a father and we have to protect women and there were feminists and people who responded very aggressively and attacked these people. And what I wished was like, hey, let me explain to you why that's not the right way to say this. And I think that's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. Like, just allow a little breathing room.
Yeah.
And don't, you know, I used to get a lot of questions about how you deal with online battles, flame wars, harassment, etc. And one of the things I tried to practice is don't assume ill intent. In fact, try to assume good intent and confer, like offer patience. Like, your gift in this moment is the assumption of goodwill, even if it's not yet been proven, and the gift of patience. And if we entered the space that way, as opposed to the assumption of ill will and the gift of impatience, right? The assumption of attack versus opening, then I think, you know, it's asking a lot, but we could approach these things differently. And Anand Giridharadas is a writer that we've known for a while. He's written and talked about this and really more eloquent ways than I'm doing right now. So I'd recommend people look that up.
You're being pretty eloquent. I'll give you that.
Thank you so much. Points for eloquence. But I just don't think it's as simple. And I'm trying to be nuanced in my words because it is a burden, right? It is work. And I just don't see a way that works without someone doing that. Everyone doesn't have to do it, but enough of us have to, you know, enter with love first.
All right. I appreciate this. It's been fantastic. Thank you so much for saying. I think you have to go catch a flight or go to some meeting or
meetings. I'm in LA. This is what we do in LA.
You're going to help me read just this little paragraph. We're going to do the thank you. Okay. I usually don't have my guests do this, but because you stayed here for a couple of nights and drank my tea.
Yes.
All right. Thank you to my guest,
Baratunde Thurston.
Now read that little paragraph right there.
If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
That's me.
You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. We don't judge. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there.
Can you tell them to really leave a review? Because people don't leave reviews.
Seriously, y'all. Nick needs reviews.
I need reviews.
His ego demands it.
Them.
Without that positive external feedback, he doesn't even know if he's here or worth anything at all. Feed Nick.
Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. Thanks to my editors at Vanity Fair. Thanks again to Baratunde. I will see you all next week, providing that we survive.
That there is a next week.
That there is a next week. That is going to be my new closer, that I will see you next week if there is a next week. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.